Welcome to the 29th episode of A Change of the Champs. My name is Ryan Lowe, and it is my goal to educate listeners, especially young ones, on the issues in this world by interviewing different experts who can lead us into the charge for change. Diversity, equity, and inclusion, or DEI. We've been hearing these words frequently the last 5 years, from schools working on belonging or corporations hoping to check a box, to politicians with questionable agendas. Some internalize these words and try their hardest to spread equality and justice. But others, whether intentional or not, miss the point and create superficial trends or buzzwords and act with self-serving motives. Sometimes it can be complicated figuring out what is what or who means well, but we have a very special guest today to help shed light on what DEI is and perhaps what could be more meaningful than it. So, it is an absolute honor to introduce today Professor John A. Powell. Professor Powell is an internationally recognized expert in the areas of civil rights, racial identity, and democracy. Currently, he's the director of the Othering and Belonging Institute, which is a UC Berkeley research institute that unites communities to eliminate barriers to an inclusive society and create transformative changes towards a more equitable world. On top of that, he's a professor of law, African American studies, and ethnic studies at UC Berkeley, and has written many articles and books on structural racism, racial justice, and affirmative action in the U.S. So how are you today, Mr. Professor Powell? It is such an amazing thing to be able to talk to you.
It's nice to talk to you as well. I'm doing well.
Your work and teachings that I've seen or heard have really inspired me, and they're just so deep and profound.
Oh, thank you. I'm glad to see that they're reaching people a little younger than the students I normally have.
You know, I've really spent time thinking about your definitions of words people use too lightly, like what we'll talk about later, belonging or bridging. And it's really important to me to be able to figure out ways to make a more permanent solution and impact.
Yeah, and it's, you know, you're going to be an adult in the world pretty soon, and hopefully the world will be a better place, a more hospitable place for you and people and the planet itself. So that's what we're trying to do. But yeah, I'm sure we'll end up passing that work on to the next generation as well.
That's what we all got to work on. So you mentioned the concept of othering and how it can lead to dehumanization of certain groups. Could you explain a little bit more about the gradient of how we other people and the implication it has on behaviors towards these groups?
Yes. Yeah, so othering is a gradient, as you suggested, and there are different ways in which we say to people through our actions, through our words, through our structures, through our culture, through our politics, through our economics. We say, you don't count. I was giving a talk earlier today and I was saying, one of the more popular books during the civil rights era was Invisible Man by Ralph Ellison. And what he was talking about is that Blacks actually were, even though they were surveilled by the state, in terms of their humanity, it was invisible. So anytime you treat someone as less than, without dignity and respect, is a form of othering. And it can range from envy to pity to genocide. So those are not all the same. So for example, people who are in our families, they may have some disability or be older. We may love them, but still pity them. May not think they're the right person to run our company or run our schools. So we have some feelings for them, positive feelings, but we also don't think they're up to the task to be fully engaged as human beings. There's a lot of example of elder abuse where we, as people get older, we, in a sense, disrespect sometimes our parents or, again, but they're still loved. Then there are people who we think of as not belonging, people who we think of as immigrants, people who we think of who shouldn't be in my community or my school through segregation. That's a different form of othering. I count othering when it goes to the extreme. We don't see them as human at all, unlike the older mother or father who we still love and care about but feel sorry for. We don't feel far sorry for this group. We just despise them. So that's the other extreme of othering, when we despise someone or feel like they're a threat. We're more likely to be violent toward them. whether it's killing them or genocide or building walls. So there's a gradient. And the solution for othering, which is happening not just in the United States, but all over the world, is belonging. One other thing I'll say, Ryan, is that I describe sort of individual othering. It's like I may not recognize someone's humanity. It's quite different when the government, when our institutions don't recognize a group's humanity. That's a different register than when an individual does not recognize someone else's humanity.
In such a range or a gradient, as you call it, it's so complex, and that might be part of the reason why it's so hard for people to call it out or recognize it in themselves. So it's a really good thing that you are distinguishing between these different types.
Right. And most of us have had what we call transitory othering. We go to a party, we're not dressed right, we weren't invited. We go to a party, they're serving food that we can't eat. People make fun of us, but then that passes. We're back into the large society. So different places where we may feel other. When you're othered by the state, when you're othered by the government, when you're othered by the powerful and the elite, it tends to be ongoing. There's almost no relief from it. And again, so it's a different register. And what we advocate is that everyone belongs. And sometimes we other in order to belong. That is, we say, this group, I don't like that group. And my being part of my group is predicated on my not liking that group. So it could be anything. It could be boys saying, we like boys, but we don't like girls. It could be someone saying, I'm Jewish, so I don't like Palestinians, or whatever, vice versa. Or I'm Christian, so I don't like Muslims. So that's where othering is used to create belonging. And we talk about belonging without othering, belonging where everyone belongs.
The complexities of both of those words all goes back to human connection, human society.
Right. And you think about it, when we're born, we're physically connected to another human being. Every one of us, physically connected. So it's not just a metaphor, it's a reality. And even as we cut the umbilical cord, we never fully cut, nor should we cut, the spiritual connection we have with each other. So we're interrelated. We're related to each other. And we're humus. Human come from the word humus, which means to be part of the earth. So we're connected to the earth as well. When we deny those connections, it causes us to suffer. It causes us to experience disease. And we have a lot of things right now to practice disconnection that causes suffering.
That's a really powerful way to think about it. So you've distinguished between transactional bridging and transformational bridging. Could you delve deeper into these two concepts and how they differ? Also, what are some ways that young people like me can build meaningful bridges?
Great question. So first of all, bridging basically, as a metaphor, suggests connecting two things, two groups, that there may be some social cleavage. So it might be that one person's Democrat, one is Republican. And so they're, in the social context, they're fighting each other and telling stories about each other. That's called breaking, when you actually exaggerate the distance between you and another person, when you refuse to listen to another person. That's called breaking. Bridging is just the opposite. Is saying, I'm going to listen to that person. I'm going to try to see that person's humanity. It doesn't mean I agree with them. It doesn't mean I abandon my own humanity or my own position. It just means that I'm trying to listen to the other person's humanity. So transactional bridging is when you're bridging to achieve something. I'm listening to you because I think if I listen to you, you might vote for my candidate, might give me some money. You might do something for me. And so in that sense, it's a transaction. You're hoping to get something from the bridging. Transformational bridging is when I'm listening to listen. I'm listening to your humanity. I'm engaging your humanity because you're a human being. And actually at that level, it's actually deeper and more things change. And that's the contradiction, because you're not listening to change. But when you listen deeply, more things change than when you listen for change. So think about it this way. Let's say you have a daughter or sister who is gay. And you say, I'm going to listen to her story about being gay. But the purpose of my listening is so that when we're done, I can talk her out of being gay. Right? That's transactional. I'm not really listening. I'm just sort of going through the motions of listening. The whole reason for listening has an ulterior motive. So transformational bridging is when you don't have an ulterior motive. It's when you're really listening because you recognize this person in front of you is actually profoundly connected to you and another human being, deserving of respect and dignity.
Yeah, wow. So what you're basically saying here is that the human desire for something in return is transactional, while being able to be open-minded and just understand another person, that's what we should be doing, right?
Well, that's certainly, I advocate that. You know, deep bridging is a deeply spiritual act, and it's akin to love. It's akin to being really present with someone else. And there's an exchange, you know, there's a natural exchange when you're present with the flower. You know, you're enjoying the flower, but you don't have to control it. You don't have to change it. But you and the flower are connected, right? And in that connection, you reclaim your humanity, because our humanity is only fully claimed when we are living in our connection.
Yeah. Connections is how human civilization is built.
That's right. And families, right? I mean, and all of us have had, many of us have had rifts with our families, rifts with our community, and we know how painful it is when people who are important to us, we have a rift with, and sometimes we heal those and sometimes we don't. So can you extend that into larger arenas? Can you care about people just because they're people? Can you care about life just because it's life? And the more we can do that, the more healing happens and the more we claim our own humanity.
If we can mend our bonds with family, we should try to mend our bonds with political parties in this case.
Well, that's right. And we talk about short bridges and long bridges. And a short bridge is maybe a bridge with someone who, maybe they took your pencil, or maybe they, you know, stole your lunch, but you don't fundamentally disagree with them. It could be your brother or your sister or your niece. You have many of the same values and maybe many of the same cultural practices. And yet you can still have rifts between them. You can still have these gaps between you. Those are called short bridges. And then they're long bridges. They're people that you might feel like they fundamentally disagree with you. They fundamentally disagree on important issues like climate, like the right to choice or abortion. And maybe they hate you. And so to bridge with those people, that's a long, difficult bridge. So we advise people when they engage in bridging to start with short bridges. And as they get better, as they exercise the muscle of bridging, they'll be able to extend it further and further.
Yeah, two big differences, but the same concept and thought at heart.
Right, exactly.
So you've also talked about the flaws with the phrase diversity, equity, inclusion, like I mentioned earlier. So what is problematic with those words? How have the 21st century corporate and social constructs perpetuated those problems? And what can replace them, both conceptually and realistically?
Well, you know, words are signifying something else. And then we debate what words really mean. So some people will say, I don't like, I've heard people say he's a diverse candidate, or he's a diverse person. Diversity is a reality in the United States, certainly in California. We may like it, we may dislike it, we may celebrate it, we may condemn it, but we live in a diverse society. We live in California where there's no racial majority, where there's more than two races, where people, every religion, every population from the whole earth is represented here in California. That's becoming increasingly true of the United States, and it's becoming increasingly true of the world. People move. So some people, have their roots in on different continents. So that's diversity. Diversity is, in a sense, descriptive. We use it in a different way. We use it like almost like I said, we're describing someone who's not, in this case, maybe white and American. But that's not what diversity means. Diversity just means by itself, you know, that we have a variation. And we live in a diverse society, even though we sometimes are segregated in our daily movement in our lives. Then we talk about diversity, equity, and inclusion. So equity was actually an effort to correct or change the way we talked about equality. So it's a big fight in the 80s and 90s as to what equality really means. Think about it, it's a very simple word. And yet today we still don't agree on what it means. Does it mean you treat everybody the same? Does it mean everyone looks the same? So there are two dominant ways of thinking about equality. In two different registers. One is you treat everybody the same, and the other is we want equality of outcomes. So one is equal opportunity. Equality means everyone has the same opportunity. That's equality in the social sense. Another is we should have the same outcome. Every group should have the same outcome. That's what we call equality of outcome. So that was a big debate in the 80s. And equity basically shifted the debate by saying, wait a minute, you have to know how people are situated in order to have this discussion. So to treat a person in a wheelchair, it's the same as you treat someone who's ambulatory, who's trying to get on an escalator. It's fundamentally different. The person in the wheelchair cannot get on the escalator. So that person may need an elevator. So you're treating that person differently. But you're treating them differently in order to achieve equality, right? So you say, how do I get from the second floor to the fifth floor? Take the escalator. Or you're in a wheelchair, take the elevator. So equity basically recognized that sometimes we're situated differently and therefore need different things. Another example, we here in the Bay Area, you might say, we make a law saying no public urination. And that applies to everybody equally. But for the person who is unhoused or homeless, where do they supposed to urinate? For most of us, we can go home or into a building. If you don't have access to a building or home, then that rule doesn't work for you. So equity is recognizing that people are situated differently. And therefore, equality or fairness means they have to be treated differently. So that's equity. In practice, equity became to mean looking at the difference between a favorite group and a less favorite group and trying to close that disparity. That's what equity has come to mean in practice. And that's too limited. First of all, even the group that's considered the more favorite group may not have really what it needs to thrive in society. And then there are a lot of groups that are marginal or disfavored. And closing the disparities is not really the goal. I'll give you an example. So several years ago, there was an effort to close the disparity between suicide, between white men and black men. Black men were much more likely to commit suicide. So they said, we want to close that disparity. White men are up here, black men are down here, or the reverse. Let's close the disparity. So they're committing suicide at about the same rate. As a result of a number of things, much of that disparity has gone away. That is, black men and white men are committing suicide at about the same rate. But the reason is not because black men are killing themselves less, it's because white men are killing themselves more. That wasn't the goal. The goal wasn't to get people to kill themselves more. The goal was to eliminate suicide. Well, then we should say that. We shouldn't just talk about the disparity. That's happened many times. So equity is too limited. It's just looking at the disparity and saying, if we close the disparity, our job is done. Well, it may and may not be done. And inclusion, so it's diversity, equity, and inclusion. Inclusion is oftentimes inviting someone in as a guest. So you invite someone to your school or your home, and they come in as a guest, and that's fine. But as a guest, you can also ask them to leave. And so a guest only feels welcome under certain conditions. So if you have new members coming into your community or your school, they don't want to feel like a guest for their whole life. When you're at someone's home and you're a guest, you're not quite comfortable. You don't feel like you can start making suggestions for how you change the furniture. So to correct both equity and inclusion, we say target universalism to correct the problem with equity. Target universalism says, what's the universal goal that we all want to achieve? No suicide. What's the strategy to get us there? So the goal is universal, no suicide. We want no group to be committing suicide. The strategy is targeted, though. It's targeted based on how we're situated. So if I'm trying to get someone to the third floor, that's the goal. The strategy may be an elevator or an escalator, depending on how we're situated. So that's called target universalism. So that corrects, and it's not tied to any one group. It's tied to our universal goal. The goal is universal, but the strategy is targeted based on our situatedness. Now let's look at inclusion. We want people to be included, but we also want them to have a say in terms of the very thing they're being included in. So if you have a number of people coming to your school from a different country, that's great. But now, do they have any say in terms of the curriculum, in terms of what sports they play, in terms of food, or do they have to eat American food even though they're from Sweden, right? Inclusion is shifted to belonging. And the belonging says you get to co-create, which means have a voice and agency in the very thing you belong to. So inclusion is joining, but you don't have a voice. Belonging is joining with a voice and co-creation.
So it seems like the problem with DEI is each one seems more like a stat that you can put on a business card or a presentation. And just the main idea is to replace that with just specifically nailing down on a person's background and what they deal with.
Yeah, that's close. And, you know, the words, we'll always debate the words because, as you said earlier, some politicians will take the word and they say, you know, we're making progress. We're never done. You know, the word equality was in the Declaration of Independence. We're still debating what it means. So we're never going to get, we can debate in good consciousness and fairness and openness. Like, Ryan, what do you mean by equality? Let me hear from you. Or we could debate in such a way as to put each other down. You got it wrong. You know, you're a communist, you know. So there's some of both. And we're never going to finally get it, but we have to have some generosity. So if you say DEI, I'm not going to attack you for saying that. I think there's a better way of saying it. And you know, someday someone may come to me and say, Professor Powell, you talk about belonging. I have problems with that. So let's talk about it. So words matter, but also how we treat each other matter. Are we willing to listen to each other? Are we willing to learn from each other? And not just, I got you because you said it wrong.
What it seems to me is all three of these questions we've gone through so far, they all in some way go back to human traits and just that behavior.
Yeah, the thing about human trait, though, is humans are complex animals, you know, where we are, you know, either both demons and angels, or we're neither demons or angels. I'll take your pick. But we're complex, and we have, first of all, we have multiple identities. You know, some days we're grumpy, some days we're generous, some days we're kind, some days we're mean. And then there are things we can do to help promote a particular way of showing up in the world. So when people are afraid, we tend to be less generous. When people are secure, we tend to be more generous. So if you want people to be generous, can you create a space where they have relative security? If you want people to be mean, threaten them. So humans have a range of possibilities. And what we're trying to do is help identify and support those things that brings out the best in us.
Yeah, we are some complex, strange creatures.
Yeah. One of my favorite animals, humans.
So one intriguing part of understanding your works for me is seeing how you do not capitalize your name. On the Othering and Belonging Institute site, it says this is because, and I quote, "We should be part of the universe, not over it, as capitals signify." So I find that a very interesting way to make a change. So could you please explain what you mean by that and how you feel such a decision can impact others?
Sure. So I started that when I was probably 14. So I did it a little while ago. But in some ways, you could think much of our approach to the universe and to nature is to be over it. We feel like extracting things from nature. We feel like nature is a dip or inert deposit of minerals and oil, and our job is just to take as much as we can. And so we lord over the universe. Newton thought the universe was basically dead and cold. You know, it's just out there to be studied and examined. And we were separate from the universe. So the universe is out there and I'm here. I'm looking at the stars and that's it. You know, I can be objective. I can look and observe things out beyond my physical being. There are a lot of teachings that suggest otherwise, that suggest that we are, first of all, part of the universe. We're not separate from it, we're part of it. The right relationship is a relationship that's reciprocated. Native American talks about Mother Earth, that they see the earth as literally part of their corporate being. And their job is to be in relationship and help take care of the earth as the earth helped take care of them. Well, to me, that sort of suggests a lowercase name. I'm saying capital name, capital letters sort of suggests the kind of, I am John, you know, capital J, you know, capital P, as opposed to I'm in relationship with all things and I'm one of many. So that was part of it. It was part of partially recognizing that there's different ways of sort of engaging life. Are we totally separate from nature? Are we totally separate from each other? Or are we in relationship with nature and in relationship with each other? And I think more of the latter. And certainly as a corrective of our extreme individualism that we oftentimes practice here in the United States.
No, I just love how deep that is. You can apply that to basically everything. That's yeah. Really cool.
Yeah.
So,
you know, it's funny. It used to be that we thought education was to help us to become fellow citizens, help us learn to take other people's perspectives, help us learn to care about other people. In the last several years, we thought of education as just for me to get ahead. It's just something about me. And we've dropped the fact that education is, and this was Jefferson, talked about education as helping us to become citizens to take each other's perspective. And as citizens, we are in relationship with each other. When I just think of me, I don't think of myself in relationship with them. It's only my concerns are the only ones that really matter.
So one topic that racists and white supremacists bring up is how our anti-racist efforts are racist to white people. So what can you say about that ideal and how we convey to them what our intended goal is when fighting justice?
Well, you know, like a lot of terms and words, they're complex. So what I say oftentimes is that analytically, white supremacy is not only an idea, it was an idea that was embraced by the United States at one point. They believed many people in the United States, including presidents, believed that the white race was the superior race. They didn't mince words. You didn't have to imply that. They said it. But they also ordered society consistent with that. They ordered housing. They ordered the way we generated loans from banks, the way they ordered schools. So you had this structure that was organized around the principle of whites being the dominant or superior race, that became fraught really starting in the 1930s, but more strongly in the 1940s. In part, the United States was embarrassed that it embraced white supremacy, and then it looked at Germany essentially adopting white supremacy and didn't want to quite be associated with Germany. White supremacy is an ideology. It's a way of viewing the world. So if you believe that white people are superior, you're embracing some notion of white supremacy. You don't have to be white to believe that. Nor does it mean that every person who is white believes that. That's a philosophical idea. It gets baked into our structures. So we have to be careful that when we say white supremacy, we're not saying necessarily that that's something that only at all white people believe. We're saying that's an ideology, that's a philosophical foundation that has influenced our country tremendously and has real consequences. But sometimes we use it as an indictment of white people. The ideology of white supremacy not only has a negative impact for people of color, has a negative impact for white people themselves. So I oftentimes say we have to learn to be hard on structures and soft on people. Instead, we're soft on structures and hard on people. I think the real pernicious part of white supremacy is the supremacy part. I would reject white supremacy, black supremacy, Asian supremacy, male supremacy. Supremacy is the operative word, and you can substitute that with dominance. So white dominance, male dominance, American dominance. Back in the context of we're all interrelated, there's no group that is inherently better than another group. And I think that's the way we have to not only express what we believe, that's the way we have to order our society.
First of all, may I say you were really good with these metaphors and that stuff. But what you're saying, it's really interesting. Like, no one should take the idea of white supremacy or dominance, as you say, and just personalize it to themselves. But that's what the society does. Hard on structures, soft on people. But we do the reverse.
Right. Well, you're confused. I mean, like, you can be mad at an ideology without being mad at the people that are implicated in that ideology. So we have to be careful, like, not to, and sometimes we do. I mean, sometimes we are mad at white people. It's like, there are a lot of white people. And white people are a spectrum. There's no one person who represents white people anymore than there's any one person who represents black people. We have a range, all of us do. But there is an ideology that was important in terms of the founding of this country. We had laws initially saying in order to be a naturalized citizen, only whites could become naturalized citizens of the United States. Those were laws won our books for a long time. That was an ideology put into practice that had an impact on the lives of people in the country.
Yeah, it's all really complex. Something I've been saying to most of these questions.
Yeah, well, complex can be good. I mean, I think one of the things to do is to embrace complexity. And as we sort of become comfortable with it, we'll see that oftentimes two things that seem contradictory are both true at the same time.
This country for centuries has been called the land of the free or the home of the American dream. But immigrants from all continents haven't been treated entirely with justice and equality. Rather, they've had to conform to the standards and norms that colonialist America has set, leaving little margin to diversify and expand on what American culture can be. So, for example, I often wonder, can the image of an American ever look like me? Everywhere I go in the U.S. and outside, people ask me, where are you really from? America's predefined, and you called that a settler mindset. So could you elaborate on the concept and show us what the alternative is and how we can get there?
Sure. So, a settler mindset is one that there's a book called Who Are We? And the author argues that we're not an immigrant society, we're a settler society. the settlers actually make the template of the country, and everyone else has to adhere to that template. And the author goes on to say the settlers were Anglo-Saxon, Protestant, essentially they were white. And so everyone else who comes, this is the conversation earlier about a guest, they come as a guest. And they, as a guest, they don't get to change the rules, change the furniture. They have to behave themselves. And in that sense, there's a one-way learning. The guests are supposed to learn the rules and norms of the dominant culture. The dominant culture is not supposed to learn the norms and culture of the guests. So people change their names, people change their food. And in that sense, this book is by Samuel Huntington. In that sense, it's basically saying you only belong if you adhere to all of these rules. To me, that's very problematic. The country is a country not of settlers, it's a country of immigrants and non-immigrants. There are people who are already here, indigenous people, and there are people who were brought over not as immigrants, enslaved people. And then there were a lot of people who immigrated here. We all make up, we're all part of this country. It's not Anglo-Saxons or Christians or whites, it's all of our country. The country belongs, if it belongs to any of us, it belongs to all of us. We need to claim it, and claim it both with our names, with our heritage. And we have a lot of language about that. You know, we talk about assimilation, basically saying, you come here and you become like everybody else. There's some of that. If you come to this country, when you're around people, they affect you, but you affect them as well. So it's a two-way street. So part of it is being open to that two-way street. I spent a fair amount of time in England, and when I first started going there, England was basically a very white Christian country. Today, the majority of people in England are not Christian. You go to London, I say, if you want to see the world, go to London. Everybody's there. There's no majority. The mayor of London is a brown-skinned Muslim, and every religion, every race is represented. To me, that's, first of all, reality. That's diversity. And on a good day, everybody, every race, gender, sexual orientation, religion is contributing to what it means to be an American. So to be an American doesn't mean to be white, doesn't mean to be Christian, doesn't mean to be this, that, the other. In fact, if anything, America is just the opposite, right? America is defined by, we're polyglot, we have many different languages, we have many different religions. And it's, some of that's enshrined in our Constitution. So we have to claim that, I think Huntington got it exactly wrong.
Yeah, our world in this country, it isn't a normal house. It's a community where we all should have a say in what everything we do.
That's exactly right.
So my very last question for you, Professor Powell, is about the future of the country. So it worries and angers me that books are being banned, that people of color are being killed on the streets, unfairly sentenced, or lack access to clean air and water. We even have politicians who are banning home ownership for immigrants. I'm 14, but I am committed to doing what I can to fight these injustices. But I have to say, it's already an uphill battle. What advice do you have for my generation of systemic change seekers, and what do you think our future holds?
That's a great question, Ryan. A couple of things. First of all, there's King talked about righteous indignation or righteous anger. What was he talking about? He was talking about exactly what you're talking about. He was saying, he's a Christian minister, he was saying God is mad. God is angry at the way we're treating each other and the way we're treating the planet. God is angry at the way we're treating God's creation. Now, if you're not a theist, I don't know if you are or not, to care is also to have pain, to have frustration, to have anger. So it's not inappropriate. If you have a dog and someone comes along and kicks your dog, it's going to piss you off. It should, because you care about the dog, because you care about the earth, because you care about people. Now, But here's the trick, though. How do you hold that and not let it consume you? So to some extent, I would say what King is talking about, righteous indignation, is really founded on love. You love the planet. You love people. You love your dog. So make sure you stay in touch with what you love, not just what you're angry about. And then also, I would say, be in relationship with others. And again, even in the midst of the frustration and anger, this is a long struggle. In fact, you could say this is life. So still make time to do what you need to do to enjoy, to relax, to exhale. It might be going for a walk in the woods. It might be skateboarding. It might be going to a movie with your friends. So make sure you make some time to tend to each other and yourself. And then I would say be in relationship with people who are of a like mind. Not only those people, but make sure you include those people. And in some ways, in my family, we would say you're blessed. You're blessed in the terms of having, obviously, a keen intellect at 14 and a podcast. You already have a reach more than most 14-year-olds. I never had a podcast. So you've been given certain tools. You'll be given more tools. How you use those will determine what the future is. The future is not set. The future is whatever we make it. And we don't have complete control, but we certainly can bend it in certain directions. So you use your agency, your voice, your heart, your spirit to make a world that's fit for all human beings and all life. And that's a noble calling if you take it up.
Yeah. Well, I do appreciate, deeply appreciate the opportunities I've been given, and I will indeed make sure to use that to make the future brighter.
Well, thank you. And I hope periodically I hear from you.
So just thank you so much for all of this, Mr. Powell. Just thank you for your work, for the minds you've changed, for the people you've inspired, like me. Just, it's amazing. It's really inspiring.
Well, thank you. Well, you know, they say everybody needs a body, so we do this together. If we turn on each other, then the future looks bleak. But if we turn toward each other, we'll be all right.
There you go again with those really good quotes and stuff. Yeah. So thank you so much, Professor Powell. And yeah, hope to see you again soon.
All right. Take care. Be well.
Thank you so much.
Bye-bye.
That's it for the 29th episode of A Change of the Chance. If you have any questions, suggestions, or things you would like to know, please send me a message. Thanks for listening, and I'll see you in the next episode. Bye!